I'm Sky Cooley.
And I'm Andrew Abernathy, and welcome to the Oddfellows Podcast, a podcast where we talk about transdisciplinary research and what it means at OSU and beyond. All right, welcome to our April episode of the Oddfellows Podcast. Sky, it's almost summer.
Almost summer. Cannot wait for summer to hit. It has been a very productive semester, but a long semester, so I'm ready to be done. Yourself?
The same. I feel like the spring semester is longer than the fall. It feels longer.
Yeah, it's because you don't have that awesome three-month gap, right? Like you go straight from the fall break, and then you're getting everything prepped, and by the time you got it prepped, you're in the middle of it. And you've got all the projects, people are graduating, and all that stuff just starts to culminate.
You go from freezing cold to starting to warming up to raining. You go from basketball season into baseball season.
Yeah.
It just feels like a lot more happens.
Yeah, you get the whole gamut of weather, too. I mean, especially in Oklahoma, right? Like, it was really hot just the other day. It's cold again. It's rainy. I like the transition, though. You know, the weather's good. Summer plans for yourself?
I am going to be writing manuscripts. I know. Very, very fun. How about you?
I will probably not be writing any manuscripts. I'm going to be going. We're traveling. We've obviously, you and I and others have the Mexico project coming up. So we'll be working with the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City, getting all that prep for late summer. But during the early parts of summer, we're going to be traveling. We're going to go to we've got a lot of our faculty friends who are from Korea. So we're going to go give that a go. And then we're going to pop over to Vietnam for a little bit and just hang out on the beach. I'm going to do nothing. I'm going to just watch the beach and the sand for a couple of weeks. That's all. That's my plan. And then we come back.
Well, you're doing it better than I am, it sounds like.
I don't know, man. The manuscript thing, I think, is really important, actually.
All right. So today we're going to have two interviews. Our first is going to be with Dr. Laura Arata, OSU history professor and the director of the Washington School History Project. And then we have our very own Miss International OSU in the house, Pratiksha Podel. We're excited to get into it. So let's get going.
Let's do it.
Our guest today is Dr. Laura Arata, OSU History Professor and Director of Public History. Arata's community-engaged work includes the Washington School History Preservation Project. As a member of the project's advisory committee, her work has supported not only preservation efforts, but also fundraising efforts totaling more than $130,000. And this was taken entirely from volunteers. Washington School, located at the corner of 12th and Knobloch Streets, was a historical hub for the black community in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Built in 1956 was the last year Washington School housed regular students prior to integration of K-12 schools in 1957. Built in a floodplain, the school has sustained water damage at multiple points in its history, and the Washington School Heritage Foundation is in the midst of its ongoing preservation efforts that would turn the building into a local community center and museum. When Arata's not helping local public history efforts, she's also a Wild West historian whose work looks at the intersection of race, gender, and popular culture. Her first book, Race in the Wild West, won the 2021 Western Writers of America Spur Award. Laura, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Always excited to talk about Washington School.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming. I had a chance that we talked a little bit earlier to look up some of your stuff. And I think that the perspective that historians bring, we oftentimes sort of, you think of history as something in the past and forget about a lot of the impact it can have on individuals in the present. And I was saying, coming from the South, I remember my grandfather talking about the Northern War of Aggression and a very like Confederate oriented perspectives. And it wasn't until, I read the Ulysses S. Grant that it was really, you got a different perspective on that history, and it sort of changes your mind. So it's really cool work and excited to talk to you today.
Thank you so much. It resonates when you talk about it that way. Cause I just think about, I grew up in the far West in California on a big ranch, and we were really steeped in that Wild West culture. And I mean, you get a sense of that through my work, that I was fascinated with that mythology of the West and what it was. And that first book, Race in the Wild West, came about because I discovered the story of this black woman named Sarah Bickford, who escaped slavery and ended up in Montana. And she became the first black female business owner in the nation. And she ran the water company there. And it's just like a way of thinking about how all things connect, right? Because very much my work with Washington School, I was in a lot of ways ready to take on because of learning about that really deeper, different history of the Wild West that I wouldn't have thought to look for had I not just been open to hearing new stories.
Yeah, so much myth and folklore associated with the West. And I think it's really an interesting thing to dive into, especially to give perspective on the Black communities that have moved out here, because oftentimes, again, that's not part of the typical lore that you see. So I think that's really awesome that you're doing that.
So, Laura, I know there's a lot to unpack here, but can you please give us and our listeners a brief history of Washington School and the current preservation project?
Happy to. So there was always a separate school in Stillwater. As long as Stillwater was in existence, there was a school for Black children. And that was part of not only local but state law. Like, as soon as Oklahoma becomes a state, segregation is enforced. It's just part of the history. So we know that there was a separate school there beginning probably a little bit before 1900. And they had initially a wood frame building. But the important thing about that is that school only went up to eighth grade. So if you are a student in Stillwater, who was African American, you didn't have the option to go to high school in Stillwater. Some students, if their family could afford it or had the resources, they would send kids to Langston or Guthrie or Oklahoma City or Tulsa. But you can imagine, like, travel at that time is a lot more difficult than it is today. And a lot of times that meant then, you know, a young teenager spending weeks, if not months, away from home and not being able to visit with their family because it's just too far to travel, even in a day at some point. So in 1938, there's federal funding to put a new school on the site, and that's when they build a brick building. And that becomes really significant because 1938, then they open a high school. Okay. And it becomes the first year in which they can offer grades K through 12. And then they actually start to bring in students from other communities who similarly don't have a high school in their local community. So it's a big year. And then their first graduate is just a couple years after that. And there's a graduating high school class every year until 1956 is the last one. So. And then there were some additions to the school in 1951. So there's some sort of auxiliary buildings around it you see today that are clearly not in as good a shape as the original building. And that's when those were added. So it's kind of ironic. They're added in 51 and then 1956. Stillwater actually integrates really early, starts integrating schools really close on the heels of Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. So they're not operational for very long, but... that's part of our challenge in saving the structures, figuring out what gets saved and then what just wasn't built with the same care.
Yeah. And then it changed, ownership changed hands a few times after it closed, but now and the city recently bought it back. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So it actually took a while for them to phase it out of being a school. So the high school grades are integrated in 1957 is the first year. Mm-hmm. And then over time, they integrate the rest of the grades.
Oh, I see.
Ending
okay.
with, I think it's like maybe K through second are the last ones. I think it's 1967 that they're integrated. So it's a phased effort. So really through the 1960s, it's still functioning as a school, but not a full, right, school with all the grades. Then it transitions. It actually becomes, it was the first homeless shelter in Stillwater. The wings that are added onto it became little individual apartments that are used.
Oh, really?
For a homeless shelter and domestic violence shelter. There was a head start in the school for a while. They used the gymnasium for community events and gymnastics and some different things. And then eventually it was transferred to, I think it's Stillwater Action Committee, which was just sort of a local organization that was trying to do different things to help the community. And so it has all of these lives, and then it was transferred into private hands, I want to say in the 90s. So it's in private hands. The private developer was planning on tearing it down. So just going to level the building, and they had it rezoned for commercial use. They were going to put in a big new office building, and then it kept flooding. And so everybody who looked at it and was, like, considering buying that as a building site was like, actually, no thank you. There's just, like, one too many things to deal with there. And so ironically, that saved it for us. The flooding saved it. And it was just kind of sitting there on the market for quite a while. which is when I happened to move to town and discover it and was really fortunate in getting people to start talking about it. So we had in 2022, an anonymous donor actually put up the money to purchase the building back and then transferred it to the city. So it's back in city ownership, okay, thanks to that private, very generous donation. So it's now back in public hands.
Well, I can see why a historian was drawn to this building to be a part of it. What an amazing like history and a history of service in a lot of respects that this place has had.
Yeah. So the preservation efforts, as you say, have kind of been formalized in 2022 when it goes back to the city. But I understand we've had a lot of fundraising success. In fact, you just had an event a couple of weeks ago, didn't you?
Yeah, we just had a gala on April 4th. That was our second fundraising event. And it's just one of these really special projects where once people hear about it, they want to get involved. And we've really seen that emerge over the last couple of years. So there was already a team of us that were working on trying to save it before that transition to city ownership. And the timing was right that we were ready. We were kind of poised to build on that success. So yeah, we had a fundraiser. Our immediate need right now is that it needs a new roof on the original gymnasium. The original gymnasium still has its redwood roof that was original to 1938.
And oh, wow.
Redwood's a really special building material in Oklahoma. Like, we don't use that very often, and it...
I don't think you can buy that anymore. Yeah,
you can't buy that.
Yeah.
It's pretty challenging, yeah, and it's just in beautiful condition. Like, you can tell that the original builders took a lot of care when they put it in. So right now, it's okay. It's okay on the inside. We had the most recent storms that we had peeled the outer roof off, and so we need to get an emergency, a new roof on that right away to protect what's underneath. And we needed about $130,000 to do that, and we raised about $130,000, uh-huh, which is incredible when you consider most people are donating, you know, $100, $200, like a couple $100 at a time. These are, for the most part, not massive donations. They're individual people in our town who want to help.
Yeah, I also think it speaks to how well you're able to tell the story of the school and make it resonate with people in a way that they want to give money. That, to me, is really a really powerful part of this. You know all about the all the wood and stuff. Andrew's a woodworking hobbyist, so he knows all about all the exotic woods and all that good stuff.
So I just captured your attention.
You did when you mentioned the redwood. You mentioned redwood.
He was locked in.
I was like, what are you doing with that one? So let's talk about Washington School as a community center and a museum. What's the vision?
The vision has always been that it gets turned back into something that's serving the community.
Okay.
And that has been driven by all of our conversations with alumni of Washington School, who, when they describe it, they always talk about it as being the beating heart of their community. The Black community of Stillwater was centralized in that little area downtown. It was outside of city limits until the 1940s. But everyone called it the Ville, and they thought of it as like this little village where that community lived, and they had what they needed, basically. There was a couple of little grocery stores. There was a laundromat there. They had a pie shop. They had a juke joint. There was like all these little things that you would need in a community. And the school really was the center of it. And that's where you went to feel safe. That's where you went to learn. That's where you went to gather. And it was things like school plays and recitals and those kinds of things were really central for the community. So alumni have always said, you know, we don't really care what it gets turned into as long as what it gets turned into is serving the community. And we've taken that to heart. So one of the visions is that beautiful gymnasium with its redwood ceiling and it's got just beautiful natural light in there will be kind of an event space that's accessible and affordable. Like, we don't have a ton of great affordable event spaces if you need sort of a medium-sized, you know, space. So hopefully that adds to the community. And then, of course, a museum. We really want this to be a hub and a heritage center. The Black history of Oklahoma is rich and it's really interesting. And like, Oklahoma had more Black towns than any other state in the nation. We love our cowboy history in Oklahoma. And some people just don't realize that 3/4 of cowboys were African American in this area. So there's just interesting history to tell. And I always say we can't honor a history we don't know about. So we just, if we talk about it, people tend to get interested because it's good stuff.
For the alumni network, I'm curious, was that when you got here, was that already active? There was like a network of people that you could talk to immediately? Okay, cool. So that's kind of how you tapped into that. That's a smart way of doing it.
The Washington School alumni have continued to have reunions every year, basically, since their school closed. They gather every year or every other year, depending, usually in the late summer, early fall. And I mean, they were several hundred strong a few years ago. They're getting older now.
Sure.
So sadly, we lose people all the time. But we've been fortunate to arrive in time to capture a lot of those stories. And OSU has been key in that. The Oklahoma Oral History Research Program has gathered a bunch of interviews, and we're still working on those things. So.
Yeah, that's great. I was going to ask you that very question. Have you sat down and actually captured their stories? But as a historian, you are already on that. Yes.
Can't let that chance get away.
So are you incorporating your students in any of this work?
Absolutely. And it's not just my students. That's one of the things that's been amazing about this project is every time we present it to students, they get excited. And it's not just history students. The first year that I actually wanted to just try and document the building because people kept telling me it's going to get torn down next week. There's no hope to save that building. It was the middle of the pandemic. And so we're all looking for things for our students to do, right, that we could do safely.
Right.
And
yes.
I had a lot of extra time on my hands to ask some more questions. And I was like, you know, I bet I could get a student team into that building. And just we'll document it. Like, we'll do our best. And so I'd gone to the engineering department and said, hey, I know your students do a senior project and they have to like deep dive into a question. Could I have a team of students to help me document Washington School and just tell me if it's about to fall down or not? That's really all we need to know right now because you can't save a building that's on the verge of collapse if it's not safe. But if it's in good condition, maybe we have some more options than we think. And so many students were interested in doing it that we ended up having two teams of engineering students.
Wow.
And they worked with some of our history students. And they were the ones who, it was OSU students who went in and were like, hey, wait a minute. This building's in beautiful shape. Nothing is getting ready to fall down in here, actually. And the students just fell in love with it. So having their energy, I think, contributed a lot. You know, to the rest of us who were looking on wondering what was going to be possible. So we've had students from history, art history, civil and environmental engineering, architecture, SMSC, geography, I think anthropology is doing some work on Washington School. So there's all kinds of different ways that different departments on campus are engaging with this, and it's been incredible.
That's really awesome. One of the whole point of the podcast, really, or part of the podcast, is to talk about transdisciplinary research, right? And so we haven't really had that student perspective on that, where you have student teams from different disciplines that are coming together to work on community-oriented projects. So what an awesome experience that you're giving to those students and that they have to contribute.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, I'm trying to imagine like getting a group of engineers and
SMSC
and budding historians and getting them to like think about the same problem and bringing their skill sets to it and getting them to see each other's strengths and ideas come to shape. I imagine as an educator, I think that would be a really exciting experience.
It's the best. It's been so rewarding. And, you know, it's brought faculty together that might not have interacted before. I've made really good friends in architecture and engineering and art history, and it's just given us all of these different opportunities to work on other projects together that we wouldn't have necessarily thought of. Just like one quick example, the engineering department, again, they do a senior project every year, and since we worked on Washington School and that was so successful, there's actually been a couple different engineering teams that have gone to other Black towns in Oklahoma to work on different problems. And now they come to us and are like, hey, could we have a historian to help contextualize?
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's a beautiful example, right?
Yeah.
We talk about that all the time that, you know, once you open up those networks and start working with folks across, you know, in a different unit, all of a sudden their network opens to you and it just extends out and we learn how to layer our expertise together. That's fantastic.
So my next question is about community partnership. This is a community engaged research / service work for you. You know, this is some work that a lot of academics don't necessarily do a lot. So my question for you was like, were there challenges that you didn't expect?
Sure. It's always challenging when you're trying to bring a bunch of people with really different perspectives together in a room and, you know, reach some sort of a consensus. But important to note here, I do public history, which is that more community engaged side of history. So that is kind of one of my specialties. So this is a great testament to how powerful that can be. The thing that's always been special about working on Washington School is that it does bring all kinds of different people together who I don't know that we would have necessarily met each other otherwise. And we have wildly different ideas on how to do things and how to reach these goals and how to make things work. And that's the strength of it, is that we're all working together, just trying to do the right thing for something that's right. A really beautiful cause and works for the community. And it's gotten us all talking. So I'm not sure how to answer that better other than that it gets us all talking and sharing and learning about this history, and it opens up doors.
I do have a follow-up question. Well, it's not really a follow-up question, but perhaps something to add some specificity. When you say public history, can you differentiate that and like talk about like what that means as opposed to a person that might be thinking more general history or individual history?
Sure. Probably the easiest way to think of it is just that public history is more applied. So history that the public engages with, if it's in museums or a historical society or saving old buildings. Traditionally, historians do deep research on a topic and write books, and that's really valuable, right? That's how we gain more information about questions from the past. And public history tends to bring those into more of a community audience.
I see.
In different ways.
That's awesome.
And another point I think we should point out, it's not named after George Washington, the first president. It's named after, correct me if I'm wrong, George Washington Carver, correct?
Booker T. Washington.
Oh, Booker T. Washington. Oh, wow. Okay.
And there's actually some disagreement about this. So Booker T. Washington is a famous orator and scholar, and he's very active, speaking engagements, lectures, writing, things like this. And there's a lot of Booker T. Washington schools that are named after him. And just in Oklahoma has like 40 or 50 of them at one point. There's one in Tulsa.
Really?
There's a Booker T. Washington school in Cushing. There's a Booker T. Washington school in Oklahoma City. We have conflicting reports. Some people say that our Washington school is named after Booker T. Washington. And some of the alumni are like, no. It's just Washington School.
Just Washington.
We just want you to call it Washington School. It's one of those little mysteries. So, yeah, but Booker T. Washington's probably the most likely. He paid a visit to Oklahoma early after statehood. And it was very widely reported on. And mm-hmm. It was, he's a pretty famous figure to be visiting Oklahoma early on. So.
So tell us a little bit about the efforts to get the school named to Preservation Oklahoma's list of most endangered places in 2022.
That was our first real victory. I think the first conversations I had about this school were in late 2020 and into 2021. And I remember one specific meeting that took place at Stillwater History Museum. It was me and the director, Amelia Chamberlain, was there. And a couple of alumni from Washington School, including Karen Washington, who's one of the really active leaders of the alumni community. Michelle Charles was there. She was at Stillwater News Press at the time. And we were just sitting around, distanced because it was COVID, wondering what might be possible. It's like, okay, so the students have looked at it. They said it's not going to fall down. We have a student opinion that it's going to be pretty safe. We knew that we had support from the State Historic Preservation Office, which had come up to see it. And Preservation Oklahoma every year makes this list of Oklahoma's most endangered places. Well, if we could get it named to that, it would at least be sort of good press, right, for the school, that it's valuable. And that really was kind of the first time in a public setting where somebody outside of Stillwater, just judging architecture in Stillwater for its own merit, said, no, this building really matters. And so, yeah, I did that application fully expecting that we wouldn't make it that year because no one had heard about this building. Nobody was talking about this building. And we're really surprised and honored to make it to the list. And it was a really special moment sharing that with the alumni community. And just, you know, for a little bit of context, Stillwater had never had a building named to that list. So it was first for our town. And it's just a great testament. It's all of our history. Right?
It's amazing how those little wins or the first win starts to stack and build and grow. I'm curious, you know, what actually got you interested into public history specifically, like that particular nuance? Is it about, well, I'll let you answer the question, but I was curious if it's about moving people into the spaces and letting them see it.
It's definitely part of it. I mean, I think my entry into public history, well, I was in graduate school and I had gone to Montana. It was just a little field school. I was not planning on being a public historian. I wanted to study World War II. That was my, I want World War II and Alaska, which I still think is fascinating and like deserves way more study than it has gotten. But I went to this little field school in Virginia City, Montana, and we were working on saving an old building that was from 1863. It was from the middle of the gold rush, and we were peeling off layers of walls that needed to be taken down very carefully to preserve what was underneath in the structure. And I just remember holding these layers of newspaper and magazines and different kinds of materials, burlap and fabric and all these different things that had been layered into the walls over time by different people that lived in that house. And just thinking how amazing it was that this was a history I could hold in my hands, and it was real and it was tangible. And then having grown up with that love of the Wild West and that absolutely being steeped in the lore of the Wild West, walking out of that building and down this little rickety sidewalk in Virginia City, Montana, which just looks like a little ghost town straight out of the movies that I watched when I was a kid, was really powerful. And I think all of us want that sense of connection with a history that speaks to us and is different for different people. So for me, it was the Wild West. For other people, it might be a Civil War battlefield or a monument related to World War II. Like, it's different. For everybody, but I've forgotten your original question now, but public history is awesome.
Yeah. No,
everybody
should
do
it. Yeah, those kind of moments really do impact you, and it's really neat that you've taken that that moment and then built an entire career that's having real impact in our community with it. So, bravo.
Thank you.
All right, so final question. Are there opportunities to get involved?
Always. So many. The next big one will be our next cleanup day, which will be coming up in the fall. It'll either be probably August or September. We've been trying to do a cleanup day about every 6 months, and those engage just tons of different people. We've had everybody from Mayor Joyce to alumni from the community to our students to different faculty, professors, all kinds of people from the community show up, and they're just really amazing days where we do things for Washington School. And so the next one of those will be coming up, and there's going to be some public meetings that are coming up in the next few months. We just got our architectural renderings.
Okay.
For
so you've got the
building.
The look.
And we're really lucky. One of our architects that's come on board worked on the Greenwood Rising Museum and has worked on Gilcrease and has got just amazing credentials. And he's been inspired by our little building, too. And can't wait to help us. So there will be a lot more chances to talk about Washington School coming up as we move into that next phase of true design and what we do with the interior of the building when it's rehabbed and what the community needs and wants out of that building. So, and we always need money. And you can go to WashingtonSchoolHeritageFoundation.org. And
send
if you're
checks.
So moved, yeah, take it. 100% of donations go directly to Washington School. We're an all volunteer effort.
Well, you've certainly sold me on wanting to go take a tour. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I want to see those renderings. Yeah,
yeah, and walk through that history. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Of course, thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Thank you. On this episode of The Odd Fellows, we're delighted to welcome Pratiksha Podel, the reigning Miss OSU International and a doctoral student in chemistry. Pratiksha researches the fascinating world of pheromone-binding proteins using 2D and 3D nuclear magnetic resonance to determine their structures. Beyond the lab, she has a passion for global travel and cross-cultural connections that have shaped her journey from international student to campus leader. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is our first time having OSU royalty, right? We've got the Miss OSU International. Before we get started with the questions, what's it like to be, although I'm going to ask a question here, obviously, what's it like to be the reigning Miss OSU International? How's that feel?
I'm really enjoying it because I'm getting to meet people from different parts of the world and learn new experience, networking. So it's really a good opportunity for me.
Yeah, I was really impressed. I went to the OSU International Cultural Night, and it was really impressive just to see, one, the amount of different nations represented on campus, two, how much the students actually really care about it and make it their own and bring their culture to campus and want to share it. I'll also say that our graduate students brought home the trophy for Team Award in Bangladesh. But it was just really impressive all around to see all the work that y'all put in and all the work that you're doing to represent culture and bring that to our campus. So bravo to you on that.
Thank you so much.
So you want to dive into some questions?
Sure.
All right. This is kind of our Odd Fellows segment where we ask kind of strange things of you and see what kind of answers we get. Andrew, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Okay. First question is a hard hitter. If molecules had personalities, which chemical compound would you want to have coffee with and why?
So I think I will pick a caffeine itself
because
it gives me energy and it doesn't let me sleep in a boring lectures or in a classroom. And I think without caffeine, my days will go like a slow motion movie. So
agreed.
It is like a little cheerleader for me.
Nice.
And also I'll pick caffeine because I also try to spread positive energy among people.
Okay.
How do you take your coffee?
Sorry?
How do you take your coffee?
Regular coffee without anything.
I'm the same way. Yeah.
Yeah, I figured you as a black coffee, yeah. Just straight up kind of dude.
Yeah, it used to be bitter for me before, but I think now I'm pretty addicted, so I can tolerate that bitterness.
I had to cut the coffee down. I went to I drink mint tea just to eliminate the caffeine. Getting old, dude. So you study pheromones. You study a lot of different stuff. Honestly, when I was looking through it, I was like, whoa, I only understand just a little bit of this. But if humans could consciously detect pheromones, like other animals, how do you think campus life would change?
So pheromone, it is a smell molecule, especially for animals. They use it to find the mate. Also, it can be used for different type of communications. But I think if human can detect pheromone, forget about the coffee shop. I think even the library can be a hottest dating spot on one end. But on the other hand, I think it can be more natural too, because you will get to know whom you get along with for group projects, friendship, and so many things.
Oh, it's fascinating. I've seen they actually sell some perfumes that are supposed to like put pheromones on your body, right? Like stuff like that to attract people.
Yes.
So if you could instantly learn any language by drinking a special chemical solution, would you do it? And what side effects would you expect?
Yes, I would love that. I would definitely want to try. But I think I will mix up every language and confuse everyone, including myself. And also, I'll probably dream different language each night.
Yeah, I have like a 2-language capacity. When I was learning Russian, my wife is Russian, and I had known Spanish before, but it was like I just replaced all of my Spanish with Russian. I was very sad that I didn't have the capacity for more.
Can only hold so much, I guess.
Yeah, I guess
yes.
So. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you one now. If you had to explain your NMR research using only dance moves, what would that performance look like? We're combining your expertise as Miss OSU and a chemist here.
That's a very interesting question. So I think, the electron in a molecule, they will start dancing in a slow dance movement. And when they get energy from external source, like external magnetic field, they will get excited. They absorb more energy and they will go to the higher state. They will spin even more. And when they are tired, they want to go back and slow down their spin and then relax. Cool. And that relaxing, that detection, we use to find a structure of a molecule, how they interact each other, how they move around each other, overall the structure of a molecule.
Wow.
You handled that with, you didn't even blink.
Yeah, the grace with which you're able to combine those is really impressive. So as Miss OSU International, you've experienced a lot of different cultures, as you mentioned before. Which country to you has the most chemically interesting cuisine, and have you ever analyzed any of your favorite foods' molecular structures?
Yes, I have enjoyed the food from every culture. They have amazing food. But if I have to pick one, I think I will still go ahead with my own country cuisine from Nepal.
Okay.
So it is like a chemistry class where you want to be in, like a blending mixer of sour, sweet, fermentation, everything mixed together. So I haven't even tried that in the lab yet, but trust me, my test board has already published a couple of papers on that.
Yeah, the Nepali food's really good. There used to be a really great restaurant in Baton Rouge that had like all the curries and the rice and stuff. It's really, really good.
Mm-hmm. All right, next up, we've heard that some scientists name their own laboratory equipment. Have you named anything in your lab? And what is it?
Well, we have not yet, but since we are talking about it, I think it is time to give name to our protein purification machine, Grandpa, because it is old, it is slow, but it gives the wisdom that we need.
I love that. So all doctoral students go through stress. I remember the process myself. I can only imagine what it's like in chemistry, right? Like in the social sciences, right? The stress, but you know, we're not curing cancer. But as a chemistry doctoral student, what are some unusual stress relievers that you've got? What's the oddest way that you've seen someone decompress after a long day of studying chemistry?
So I think I've seen people talking to the instrument as their therapy and also giving some dance move when reaction finally works or finally when they get the result. Or some people, they just go to the gym and hit the gym to relieve out the stress.
Yeah, gym's a good way. It's a solid, productive way of relieving. Did you ever hit the gym when you were in there, your doctoral program?
Only in the morning, not, you know, that's a pre-research
activity. Yeah, it's a
preset. Getting energy.
Yes, yes, yes. I don't know who these people are who can work all day and then go to the gym. I can't do it.
I was a night workout guy. I thought it kind of reset the day, but like the mornings is what I can't do. You always wake up like super early.
I start at 5 a.m. Yeah.
I'm not a morning person.
Yeah. Okay. So if you could instantly transport your lab to any location in the world for a month of research, where would you choose?
I love traveling. I would definitely love to take my lab to every part of the country, many places in the world. But again, if I have to pick one, so for right now, I will pick my own country, Nepal. It's just because I will be closer to my family members, and I will get an opportunity to share the knowledge that I have or show them the lab, how it looks like, those kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's an amazing service mentality there. I was, you know, thinking like Italy, you know, my mind's going to, you know, like a beach. Uh-huh. But no, that's great. You want to go home and share the knowledge. It's fantastic. So last question. What's the strangest misconception someone has about your research when you try to explain it at parties? Like when we try to talk about our research in the academy, always really difficult. What's the strangest misconception people have when you try to explain what it is that you do?
People think that I'm designing perfume in the lab. And some people, they also think that I have money because I work on the pheromone. So they think that pheromone is a money because they attract male or something. But I tell them that I'm not a perfume designer. I'm trying to understand how a small smell molecule helps another insect.
Nice.
Things like that.
Well, before we lose your day, I do want to talk to you a little bit about your research and your decision to pursue the Miss OSU pageant, if you have time. So tell me, what all goes into becoming Miss International OSU?
One male and one female, they can represent their country. They can participate. Mm-hmm. So there will be Mr. Separately and Miss separately. And there will be talent round where you give your talent.
Okay.
And there will be question answer round. So both of those sections will have different marks. So at the end, they will combine and then add up the marks. Whoever gets the highest marks.
So it's like a real pageant competition. What's your talent?
Well, I did some dance and I gave a story, where I came from, coming from a small village in Nepal and how I ended up here, encouraging people to believe in themselves and never lose hope just believe in yourself. That was my platform, I'll say.
So what motivated you to come to Oklahoma State to study chemistry?
Actually, one of my friends recommended me, but I am so glad I picked OSU with the amount of good community, all different types of organization we have here. And I'm a kind of person who likes to go around, and if it's a small place, I cannot stay there. But I've been involved in lots of organization. I have seen lots of people, good humanity, and I'm really glad that I picked OSU.
Well, we're glad to have you. I mean, it really is impressive all the different things that students can get involved in while they're here, and you really represent that quite well.
Yes, even if you have stress on your lab or something, you have something else where you feel happy.
So what got you into pheromone binding proteins?
Actually, my background, my undergrad is from biomedical science. Mm-hmm. So this protein, it is mostly biochemistry. So I wanted to pick something in between biology and chemistry. And that is how I find the research my professor was doing in the lab. So I joined her.
Okay, great. And so like what problems are we looking to address in this area of research?
Okay, so a female moth, when release pheromone, so male gets attracted because of the smell of the pheromone.
Okay.
And these moth, they are pest, and farmer, they use pesticide to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. So this causes negative effects to the environment, you know, like pesticides, harming ecosystem, water system and everything. So we are studying this protein that plays a role for finding the mating, and which are pest. So if we find the structure of the protein, we can design some pheromone mimetics so that can block the binding of the pheromone to the protein so male cannot smell.
Ah.
So it is like ecological, agricultural strategy to get rid of the pesticides.
Cool. So in those specific zones where the farming's taking place, they wouldn't be able to smell one another, essentially. So they have to move outside of that.
Yes. So they will get confused with the mimetic pheromone.
Nice. And this is an alternative to having to use pesticides
on
crops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
That's a great idea.
That's amazing.
It's a wonderful, again, the ability to take research and apply it to like real world problems, that really is the crux of what we talk about a lot on the show. And so it's really awesome to see a doctoral student already thinking about the ways that their work can be applied and make difference in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It is my pleasure to be here.
The Odd Fellows is a production of the Oklahoma State University College of Arts and Sciences. It's edited by B.B. Sultana with production support from Keith Maddox. If you'd like to have your research featured, email us at oddfellows@okstate.edu. And as always, go Pokes!